Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 19, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. This is the very first teaching ever given by the Buddha, and everything that he would teach for the 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of these Four Noble Truths and Dependent Origination. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this is, this week we're on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. This is the third talk this week on. I'll give one more on Saturday. The Tuesday night talk, the video didn't record. There was some glitch going on here. This morning, this noontime talk today, there's also a video recording in tonight's talk. Obviously, it's all on the same subject, but I'm going to go at it a little bit different tonight than I did the first two talks. To put everything in context, and this is probably the most important time to put things in context, talking about the Buddha's very first teaching. The Buddha sought out and discovered the nature of human suffering. And along the way, he also discovered how to bring our individual contributions to our suffering and the world's suffering to cessation. What he awakened to is known as dependent origination, which states that it is ignorance of four particular truths that lead to all manner of suffering. That one sutta, which I guess you could call it a primary sutta, has been altered and adapted and embellished beyond any recognition to what the Buddha taught. It began pretty early after the Buddha's passing, even during the first Buddhist council. There was talk of it. By the second Buddhist council, the Theravadins had adopted a third book to the Pali Canon called the Abhidhamma, and that included an elaborate depiction of creation, calling that dependent co-arising or dependent origination. Again, it bears no resemblance. And also at that time, there was a sect called the Mahasanghikas that were getting more and more well-known and more powerful within the Sangha. And they wanted a much more visionary type of Dharma that related more to the Vedas, the precursor to modern Hinduism, and the common spiritual thinking of that time, which was rooted in the idea of appeasing and working with and avoiding the bad ones. I'm talking about gods and deities. And Brahmins, not Brahmins, Brahmins, which is a little bit a technical separation between teachers of spiritual teachers during the Buddha's time and exalted people who had exalted knowledge of that teachings. Brahmins were the teachers. Brahmins were the godlike creatures. Of course, it's all speculation. It's not something the Buddha taught. And even in this sutta, he makes it very clear that upon his awakening, his quality of mind is unexcelled in the universe, and then he mentions including gods, deities, divas, Brahmins, royalty, etc., etc. In other words, his awakening far surpasses any other understanding that's ever been out there. And he also makes the point, which is important here because it goes against what almost everybody says, is that the Buddha discovered a Dhamma that's been around forever, and you know, he just rediscovered it. And the Buddha says repeatedly here, but also all throughout the suttas, that this is something that humans have never heard before. He says it over and over again. So then the Buddha awakened to dependent origination. His very first teaching then was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which for the first and only time in history set this wheel of truth in motion. The reason why I say that is the later developed schools talk about the Buddha set the wheel of truth in motion three times. And when you read why they're even adopting that, It just doesn't make any sense in relation to what the Buddha taught. It's okay to find and establish religions based on speculation and belief. That's what most religions are based on. The Buddha wasn't interested in speculation or doing things just based on what somebody else or a group of people said. He continually said, you have to see this for yourself. And even when he was questioned, this came up in the Kalama Sutta, the group was saying these spiritual teachers all come through here. They all claim that we have the one true Dhamma. How do we know? How do we know you're not like all the rest that have disappointed us? He said, the only way you can know is to see for yourself. And even that sutta where the Buddha says, the only way to know if my sutta is effective for you is to actually develop it, has taken has given modern Buddhism the license to change it wherever they want, because the point that I'm saying, the Buddha said what we don't like, we can do what we want with and adapt it and fit to what we, the Buddha never said that. In that sutta, he also said, if you have a question about this, question me directly. And that makes sense. A teacher would want to be questioned directly rather than having somebody remain confused. But he never says you should question everything I say. That would be just the idea of creating something like that is foolish. Why would somebody spend 45 years of their life teaching a very specific Dhamma, completely unambiguous, especially when you read the suttas? Why would he teach it so clearly, so directly, and then say, but you can just forget it all, it's all nonsense? I mean, he never said it, and he wouldn't say it. So his very first teaching was this Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta to the five friends that he had been seeking understanding with. His next sutta is called the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, which is a sutta where he teaches the not-self characteristic. And then the third sutta that he ever gave is called the Fire Discourse, where he teaches how dukkha arises. So when you look at these first three discourses in relation to dependent origination, you see the importance of understanding them and the importance of understanding the context in which the Buddha taught. Because if you don't understand the context, meaning the purpose of the Buddha's teaching and what he discovered, was ignorance of Four Noble Truths leads to all the suffering in the world. And included in just that line is the key to the understanding. If it's ignorance of Four Noble Truths is a problem, then the solution is gaining knowledge of Four Noble Truths. It makes sense, wouldn't it? And so why would we come up with something else when an awakened human being has declared, I figured it out, and this is it. And then he explains very clearly how to develop the path. That when you, and I think you've gotten it here because you come to these classes, the Buddha didn't leave anything up to the speculation, and he taught how to directly experience the things that he wants us to experience. He gave us an eightfold path to do that. And you'll see how he makes that very clear in the sutta. And then just to touch on those other two suttas, again, just to put in context, Kevin will probably remember, I know Diane, you might from the first, we might not even got to it in the retreat that you went on. But now I always establish on retreat the context of dependent origination and these first three suttas. And because everything that followed from that was in this context, included the suttas that I call superior only in the material they cover, such as the Anapanasati and the Satipatthana Sutta. But you don't even know how to apply those because they refer to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path unless you understand dependent origination and Four Noble Truth, at least on an intellectual way. So that's the long introduction to this. What I'd like to do, because I've read through this and commented as I was going along, I'm going to attempt to just read through the whole sutta. We'll see how I do with that. And then if you have any questions while I'm reading it, please ask, but keep our comments and discussions till after the talk, just because that's important, I think, to at least get one of these talks complete. So you have the background. The Buddha, so again, this is 2,600 years ago. We're hearing the words of an awakened human being, his first words on what he discovered to his five friends. And I think you've heard me talk, not to lose the suspense, but upon hearing this, one of the Buddhist friends awakens from just hearing this clear and simple and direct Dhamma. And remember that in the next teaching the Buddha gave, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the other four folks awaken. And during the Buddha's time, it said by the time he gave that third discourse, there were over 1,000 followers now, and this is over just a few months, and about 500 had already awakened. Again, speculation, there's no way to know, but the point is that people that heard the Buddha's Dhamma and took it to heart and developed it directly awakened. It didn't take them endless eons like it's often told today, or an even impossible task. That awakening, as the Buddha describes awakening, is beyond human beings, and that's often portrayed today. It's just ridiculous. The Buddha was a human being who taught other human beings how to develop what he had developed. And there's nothing mystical, magical. It doesn't take any special powers. It just needs a direct engagement with the Eightfold Path. Again, that's what the Buddha taught to awaken. The Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. I have heard that on one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Varanasi in the game refuge at Isipatana. There he addressed a group of five, his five friends. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth, meaning one who has left the world behind seeking understanding. So this is in general to any spiritual seeker. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects. This behavior is base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. It is devoted to self-affliction. That which is devoted to self-affliction is always painful and ignoble. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way is realized by the Tathagata, meaning Buddha is referring to himself there. This middle way produces vision and knowledge. This middle way leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to abiding. That, again, I got to comment a little bit on this. That last is how the Buddha described awakening. The quality of mind is calm, and this person has unbound themselves. They release themselves from clinging to ignorant views. It makes sense how it fits in. I know I promised I was going to. The Buddha's talking about, the two extremes that he's talking about are the common extremes still today and that were observed during the Buddha's time. One extreme would be complete sensory indulgence, that's the materialistic or even the humanistic view. You can call it a humanistic philosophy today, but back then, the idea was that we have one life, there's no consequences for however you live your life, so indulge and get as much of it as you can, much like that saying, life is a banquet, don't leave the table hungry or something like that. A more reasonable thing is, life is a banquet, take only what you need. Because the catch is that big banquet table that we think we're supposed to have everything of, and that I deserve as much of it as I can get. Well, that's just all ego-based, and it's the basis of suffering. The other extreme that the Buddha experienced is complete asceticism, meaning denying yourself every possible human need, so much so that, like the Buddha, you're living on a grain of rice or one bean a day. He knows these two extremes because he lived them. He lived the extreme sensory indulgence as a prince in his father's kingdom, and he put himself through the suffering of extreme asceticism, finding both of them lacking, both of them distracting, neither one leading to the goal. And so even though the same ascetic practices that the Buddha talked about back then weren't useful, those same practices are being performed today all over the world, particularly in northern India, and in many aspects of modern Buddhism, that type of asceticism is still taught as useful. And to me, when I was able to kind of extricate myself from that modern thinking, even the reasonable, somewhat reasonable ways that some of the Dhamma is taught, to me, is a practice of asceticism, such as retreats that are forced silence for days and days and days on end. The Buddha never taught that. That type of sensory denial is asceticism, something that is an extreme view that the Buddha never taught. Yet most people think I must be a little crazy because I don't lead silent retreats, but you know why I don't do that. And even forced long periods of meditation, such as on sesshins, I was on 7 and 10 day sesshins, where you're meditating 14 to 16 hours a day, day after day after day, 7 or 10 days. And I can tell you from my experience, the best thing about those types of meditation sessions, this is me, there's a lot of people that get great benefit. The best thing for me out of those long forced meditation sessions and forced silence to go along with it was that they came to an end. Honestly, I never got anything more out of it, but the relief that what I had just put myself through has come to cessation. I was always confused, always blaming myself that I must have been done something wrong. I'm not meditating correctly. I just don't have it. I'm not good enough. Or it is going to take endless eons. And in the end, it was just another experience in dukkha, meaning disappointment. It wasn't until I came across the Buddha's teachings on meditation, the proper application in the Eightfold Path, that it had great meaning and purpose and literally changed everything. The Buddha's Dhamma. Okay, so I'm not going to comment at all while I go through this. So the two extremes. That which is devoted to self-affliction is always painful and ignoble. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way is realized by the Tathagata. This middle way produces vision and knowledge. This middle way leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. And now the Buddha describes very clearly what it is. And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings etc., etc.? It is precisely this noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Now, obviously, that using the word right or skillful or appropriate view, etc., is a translation. But the point that is made here, and you could use any one, you could call it right view or skillful view or appropriate view, but it points out the importance of discernment, and we should learn how to recognize the difference between right view and wrong view, right speech and wrong speech. Right, an awakened human being wouldn't teach this as his Dhamma if it wasn't singularly important. And because these things like views and intentions and moral behavior is almost taken for granted, the importance of developing the Eightfold Path is nearly entirely dismissed in modern Buddhism today. I know that's, to some people on the outside, that might sound like an outrageous claim, but how could Buddhism not include the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path? But I can tell you, I spent many, many years in modern Mahayana Buddhism and never, hardly ever heard it, and was certainly never taught how to develop it. Never, ever. And hours, literally years in monasteries and speaking directly with teachers, some of the most well-known teachers, by the way, never did they mention Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. And if they talked about anything, it was usually a misapplication of dependent origination that was influenced itself by the Abhidhamma. Completely confusing. And to me, a completely useless Dhamma. It led me to more confusion. And the reason why I'm saying that and giving emphasis, that when you read these words, it's impossible to get lost in the Dhamma unless you completely ignore it. The problem of ignorance is that we create problems to ignore our own ignorance. And we've certainly done it with the Buddha's clear and direct path. The Buddha concludes that recitation of the Eightfold Path by saying, "This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm, to self-awakening, and to unbinding." He's repeating that. I said this a little bit earlier today. Sometimes repetition in the suttas is necessary for the remembrance part and how Buddhists during that time used chanting, meaning the repetitive expression of a teaching, to help memorize it and preserve it. But in this sutta, the Buddha is using repetition to really emphasize the point of awakening. There's no way that we can lose sight of the fact that the point of the Buddha's awakening is to develop a calm mind that is unbound from wrong views. He says it repeatedly here. And then how we could get confused about even what the Buddha teaches, because this is the phrase I'm going to say now. He says it repeatedly throughout the Pali Canon. The Buddha states unequivocally, "I teach the truth of stress or dukkha and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. Nothing more." And again, he reiterates that. There's most famous Buddhist scholars today, even those that are leaning towards the Theravadan side, will say, "Well, the Buddha didn't really say that, and he really meant to be teaching a lot more." Well, then why would he say this? Again, the only way that you can continue to ignore what the Buddha teaches is to 2,600 years later put words in his mouth and go against the preserved teachings. And if you understand how the Sutta Pitaka has been maintained, you would realize the foolishness in even trying to do that, because it's one of the most remarkable achievements of humankind. I mean, to me, it's the greatest achievement that these teachings from an awakened human being have been preserved in their original format. Then the Buddha states, let me put that in the context too. "I teach the truth of stress or dukkha and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of stress, nothing more. And this is the noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful, aging is stressful, death is stressful, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are stressful. Furthermore, association with the unbeloved is stressful, and separation from what is from those loved is stressful. Not getting what is craved for is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. The five clinging aggregates of form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness, meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance, is the ongoing personal experience of suffering caused by clinging to wrong views." And that's all the five clinging aggregates describe. There's nothing all that hard to understand, except when we try to relate it to our views of self, it's an impossible task, because it creates a feedback loop in our mind. It's enough to understand the concept that something has been created from my own ignorance that causes me to suffer. It's the five clinging aggregates. The Buddha's description of suffering is simply a description of having a human life, isn't it? So when we, again, if we understand this directly and don't try to change this, we get right to the heart of the matter immediately. The problem is that I want life to be different. I don't want there to be birth, sickness, aging, death. I don't want to be disappointed when I don't get what I want. And I don't want to receive things that I don't want. I want what I want. Right? That's why I call awakening is really developing full human maturity, because that's how an immature person acts. They get upset when something happens to them that is contrary to what they want. That's childish behavior. And what the Buddha is describing here is simply describing human life. As a consequence of human life, there's going to be dukkha. Dukkha occurs. That's what the Buddha is stating here. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the origination of stress. So the Buddha describes the experience of stress, the first noble truth, dukkha occurs. The origination of stress is the craving that makes for further becoming rooted in ignorance. So it's craving for those views that we've established, self-referential views, rooted in craving for a self-referential existence that we are now clinging to, that is necessary to maintain an experience of ignorance. Ignorance has to continue to ignore its own ignorance. The craving that makes for further becoming. Remember that becoming now we're talking about, and you have to understand the context of the Buddha's teaching. Rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of suffering arises. Rooted in ignorance, craving rooted in ignorance, one can only become further ignorant. It makes sense, doesn't it? If my framework of my thinking right now is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths and nothing changes to elevate my teaching, I can only continue with that same type of ignorant thinking, correct? You both agree with that?
Yes.
Excuse me for asking, but I can't see. When you're that far away, I can't see if you're shaking your head, so you have to respond. And that's the basic essence of the Buddha's Dhamma. We're ignorant of Four Noble Truths, and forget about where the ego wants to go. I'm not ignorant. We're not talking about a general ignorance. The Buddha said we're ignorant of Four Noble Truths. If you can't accept that, then maybe the Dhamma is not for you. But if you can accept that the problem of stress and suffering in your life is caused by a lack of understanding of the way things are, that kind of makes sense, wouldn't it? Because if you go just a little bit further and say, if I really understood my life, it wouldn't be so distracting or disturbing to me because I understand what's occurring. If I understand what's occurring, I won't take it personal, will I? Hopefully I won't. Again, that's the Buddha's teachings, so that we don't take things personally, so we don't self-identify with everything that occurs. Anatta, a self rooted in wrong views, must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. Again, sorry for getting off track, but it relates directly to this. That craving that makes for further becoming and accompanied by passion and delight. It we're taught that we should have passion and delight for our life, for our life rooted in ignorance. And there's something wrong to look at it in this way, in the way the Buddha taught. The Buddha is simply saying, he's not teaching a melancholy or a nihilistic type of Dhamma. He's just simply saying, look at your life. It's prone to these types of disappointments. Don't want it to be any different. But if you're stuck in ignorance, you can't help but want it to be different than it is. It's not wrong. In fact, it's an awakened human being who's not thrown away or thrown around by passion and delight in everything that occurs. The Buddha describes, in other ways, an awakened human being as someone who is disenamored with their life, which means you're simply disenamored with continuing to establish a self rooted in ignorance. It doesn't mean that life doesn't have meaning. In fact, it has great meaning and purpose when we're living from right view, from an awakened right view. Accompanied by passion and delight, relishing here and now there. That means that's how anatta establishes itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. Whether it's past, present, or future, whether I see myself in downtown Frenchtown teaching a class, or if I'm into tomorrow having a nice lunch somewhere, or I might be arguing with my boss, or my dog did something, anywhere else but here. No matter where I find my mind, that's where I'm establishing myself. Here and there, accompanied by passion and delight, here and there, or upset. Always establishing a self where a self isn't there. There's no me yesterday. There's no me even a moment ago. We know that. We know that for a fact, that even the human body, every moment, throws off millions of cells, and new cells are born each and every moment. And I certainly can't establish myself in the future, can I? Although I'll try awfully hard to do it, especially if I got something coming up that I'm concerned about. I might be in the future all day today, which means I lost today. If I'm in tomorrow because of what's coming up tomorrow, I'm not living today. And if I'm stuck in regret about what happened yesterday, and I hope it doesn't happen again today, and what's going to happen tomorrow, I've just lost my life. And I've lost my life because I've lost my mind rooted in that ignorance of Four Noble Truths. My mind wouldn't go to those things if I had a well-developed, well-concentrated mind, would it?
No.
It's not possible. It's not possible to lose your mind in that way once you've developed the Buddha's path. There's no ignorance left to drive that type of experience. The Buddha continues, and this month is a noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, the letting go of what? What do we need to let go of?
Ignorance.
Yeah, what does ignorance produce? I'm being a little cryptic. That very craving. Yeah. Letting go of that very craving. But what's the Buddha asking there? It seems, and it is very simple and direct, the very letting go of that craving. It means to cease all of your self-referential thoughts that are ceasing to establish you in every thought, word, and idea, here, there, and everywhere. That's the craving that drives further becoming. I need to continue to establish, I need to satisfy the self, moment by moment. And those of us that have developed the Dhamma a little bit realize how tenacious and incessant that need is. It's constant. That's the real stress that's underlying us. It's a constant, tenacious need to establish a self and to satisfy a self moment by moment as life occurs. It's an impossible task. And yet we buy into it very, very early in life. It's supported by our society in a very, very powerful and subtle ways. And it's usually supported by our associations and other groups that we become with. That's another reason why the Buddha taught to, at least as far as the Dhamma is concerned, to be very cautious and very discerning with your associations, and especially in the Dhamma. And I know that from firsthand. In the Dhamma, you can't help. I was a great Tibetan Buddhist for many years. And then I was a great Zen Buddhist for many years. And then I became someone who follows a Buddha and I learned something. But along the way, I had a very strong association with my Tibetan friends and my Zen friends. So much so that even things that they were saying that I intuitively knew was wrong, absolutely knew it was wrong, I would allow for it simply because I'm now part of this association and I had to. That's also the nature of ignorance, to adapt itself into anything that makes itself feel comfortable and establish its view in the world. Just its nature. And the Buddha continues, and this, monks, is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. It is precisely this noble eightfold path. And then he names him again. Having developed that path, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me. This is important. Within me. Again, the Buddha's making a strong statement to his five friends, who, and most of the spiritual seeking during that time was externally focused, just like it is in our day, that salvation comes from an external agency or force, or in some way bestowed on us based on merit or kind acts or appeasing gods, deities, but not something that developed within me that I was responsible for. It's never presented that way. The Buddha does. It arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. And he restates that, but that's so important because, again, most of modern Buddhism say the Buddha simply discovered a path, a timeless path that's always been around, and he just rehashed this whole thing. And that allows the Mahasanghikas and the introduction of the Abhidhamma to have some foundation. The Abhidhamma talks about that too. So the Theravadins, at least at the time, wanted to have a more mystical and magical Buddha god too. And so here comes the Abhidhamma to justify that. Illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. Dukkha occurs, the first noble truth. The Buddha continues, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. The noble truth of stress is to be understood. You know, this simple, direct, this is what we're supposed to do with this Dhamma. You could look at it as a task to be accomplished. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. Again, making that point. The noble truth of stress has been understood. So he's describing what needs to be done, and then he's making the declaration, I have understood it. The noble truth of stress has been understood. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me, again, with regards to things never heard before. He's laying out the Dhamma in a slow and deliberate way so that we can understand how the parts fit together and how they developed in his own mind with regards to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of the origination of stress, meaning he understands it now. The noble truth of the origination of stress is to be abandoned. He understands that this is what I'm supposed to do with this. And then he declares, this noble truth of the origination of stress has been abandoned. I've abandoned craving. I've recognized the problem, and I have abandoned the problem. Now, because of that, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is a noble truth of the cessation of stress. He understands it. This noble truth of the cessation of stress is to be directly experienced. Now he's saying, I've experienced it. You must do the same. The noble truth of the cessation of stress has been directly experienced. Now he's talking about himself, and he's teaching these folks, these five friends, this is what you must do. And again, can you see how there's no ambiguity at all in these teachings, is it? It's simple and direct. This is what I did. This is what you will do. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. Reading all the suttas that I had, I've never come across anything where I said, boy, the Buddha's really getting long-winded here. Even here, the repetitiveness gets to me, but I realize that the Buddha never wasted a word. Even though he used a lot of them, he had a great economy of words because he always got to the point. Every word had meaning. And that's it. He's making the point over and over again. This is a fresh new teaching to his friends. Keep yourself in that setting. This is something you've never heard before. He's telling them that because they've studied with all kinds of different folks all through those 6 years that he was wandering around northern India. And he's saying clearly, all those studies with all those great teachers, nobody touched on this. Now remember, he studied the Vedas and the Upanishads and all the other so-called great teachings of his time and rejected them all, including those. Those were some of the first things that he said. And again, I'm not putting it down. They're not a Buddhist teaching. They didn't lead him to awakening. There's no reason to conflate the two. It's always surprising to me where, and it's mostly Hindus that claim that the Buddha was a Hindu. And again, I'm not putting Hindus down. It's just that he never was. And there's no reason to equate or conflate what the Buddha taught with what is included in the Vedas and the Upanishads. With regards to things never heard before, this is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. He's figured it out. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress is to be developed. Now, again, keep this whole sutta in context. He just said that it's the Eightfold Path that develops cessation. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress is to be developed. He's simply reiterating what really should be obvious to these folks and to us. I've taught you an Eightfold Path. It's a path to be developed. It's not something to be mentioned or noticed or even debated. People still debate the Eightfold Path. It's to be developed. There's no other instruction. There's no other thing to do with it. And why would we want to do anything else if we hope to awaken except develop an Eightfold Path? And now the Buddha is describing what occurs for awakening to occur. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress has been developed. Clear and direct. Now he says, and this really gives the whole sutta a lot of emphasis. Monks, remember there was only a few of them. I try to be gender neutral when I'm talking. Monks, as long as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths was not pure, I did not claim to have directly self-awakened. Remember when the Buddha talked of himself prior to his awakening, he almost always referred to himself, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva or bodhisattva, which is another comment on the modern bodhisattva past that I often make, I won't tonight. But he's describing himself as, even before my awakening, I was a human being that had great compassion for other human beings, but I was an unawakened bodhisattva, and my compassion was unawakened, which means I was still prone to causing suffering in the world. And we can easily look at how well-meaning people have created suffering in the world. But upon his awakening, when he understood, when his release became unprovoked, there was nothing else provoking him towards ignorance, then he claimed to be rightly self-awakened. It wasn't until that point, and this is another, again, he's teaching how to develop the Dhamma. Don't be so concerned with, are you awakened yet? You'll know it, but develop the Dhamma. And how will you know it? Because we become rightly self-awakened. We understand it. Now the Buddha declares, and this is getting into Dhammas that would have us appeasing or appealing to gods or trying to gain benefit or merit from doing good works, and that will lead to our awakening. My self-awakening is unexcelled in the cosmos, even with all the deities, the Maras, the gods, the Brahmas, with all the contemplatives and Brahmins, with its royalty and common folk. My awakening, the Buddha is saying, is unexcelled. So why would we seek an awakening that is less than what a Buddha awakened to by appeasing or appealing to gods or deities? The Buddha is saying, he's not saying there's no such thing as gods or deities. He's saying that the belief is completely unimportant. And he has to address it because it's a common belief as his time. People that were spiritual seekers sought spiritual masters to guide them through and to take them through. The Buddha said, no, that's not it. It's just foolish thinking. My awakening is way beyond, he doesn't say that, it's unexcelled, which I guess you could say is way beyond. It's unexcelled in the cosmos, everywhere. And it applies everywhere. It's unexcelled. So stop looking at deities and Brahmins and gods and contemplatives for your salvation. Where is it found? I found it within me. And this is how to do it. Again, when I look at it in its correct light, it's the most remarkable teaching I've ever come across. And, you know, I've been teaching for a lot of years. And even now, I can feel how powerful this teaching is. It's still with me. The Buddha continues, but as soon as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths was truly pure, then I did claim to have directly self-awakened, an awakening unexcelled in the cosmos. Knowledge and vision arose in me, unprovoked is my release, meaning there's nothing less, there's no ignorance left to provoke his ignorance. This is an important line too. This is my last birth. The Buddha is talking about future births. He's declaring that I never will have one, despite the common myth that there's a future Buddha coming as savior, much like the myth of, well, I don't know if it's, maybe it is not a myth, the second coming of Jesus Christ. That may or may not be true, but I know that the second coming of the Buddha is not true because he's declared it over and over again, not just here. And there's no reason for him to be here because he's awakened. There's nothing to bind himself to this plane of existence prone to suffering. He's done the deed. He's completed the task, and there is no reason for that. And you know, right during the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when Ananda realized the Buddha was passing, and he was so upset, he says, who are we going to listen? Who are we going to follow? What's going to happen to us? The Buddha said in a very calm voice just before he passed, is I'm not like a teacher with a closed fist. I've held nothing back. I've given you everything you need. Now remember, impermanence and decay is relentless. Talking about the importance of understanding impermanence, much like Khandana got it in this sutta. Impermanence and decay is relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. He didn't say do a lot of chanting because the end's coming. He didn't say do a lot of rituals. He didn't say do a lot of praying to the gods. Strive diligently for your own awakening. And that was the end of his dispensation. The last thing that he could possibly say after all those years of teaching is take to the Dhamma. Nothing else. You think about that. This is an awakened human being giving his last bit of advice, and it could have been anything. It could be eat your Wheaties or drink your milk. It's strive diligently for your own salvation. And he's reminding us that there's nothing hidden or nothing mystical about this Dhamma. He's held nothing back. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. For me, there is now no further becoming. Now, of course, the Buddha continued to become the most important human being that ever lived. So he's not talking about annihilation by that. He's talking about there's nothing left in him to become further ignorant. Hence the name of the book. The whole notion of becoming Buddha or becoming awakened is included in that understanding. If we're to become awakened, as the Buddha teaches awakening, I don't know why we want to do something else, it makes sense that we would follow what the Buddha taught. And as you can see in this sutta, it's so clear and direct. There's no reason to get lost in the Dhamma itself. So this concludes this. That is what the Buddha said. The group of five monks were delighted at his words. While this discourse was being given, Venerable Khandana declared, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. What he's speaking to, obviously, is impermanence, the impermanence of all things, but most importantly, the impermanence of a conditioned mind, because he finally realized that the cause of all of his stress and suffering was his mind that was conditioned in ignorance. And upon hearing this, he declared, all conditioned things, including my conditioned mind, which is impermanent, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And the Buddha declared, you are now Anakandana, the one who understands. A pretty emphatic statement, isn't it? Relating to when all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. But he understood, the Buddha understood, that Khandana, by making that declaration, is expressing his understanding of the three marks of existence, of impermanence and not self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. Now, there's a few things that are important about that. As individuals, as we take to the Dhamma and continue to integrate the Four Noble Truths into our life by the refined mindfulness that holds in mind each factor of the Eightfold Path, we are moving ourselves towards awakening, and that's something that we should acknowledge, that that's what we're doing, that it's possible. And how is it possible? Well, we know at least two folks that have done it, Khandana and the Buddha. But if we read the suttas, there's many, many hundreds of others that awaken by simply listening to these words. Now, the Buddha wasn't a miracle worker. He had no power to bestow awakening on anyone, despite the nonsense of mind-to-mind lineage. He couldn't transmit, if the Buddha couldn't transmit his awakening to another mind, there's certainly not a mind around today that can do it, at least that I've come across. And if it was possible for a Buddha to somehow do that, it would have just been done. There'd be no need for the Dhamma. The Buddha would just awaken everyone. It's not possible. Because Siddhartha Gautama wasn't responsible for my ignorance, Siddhartha Gautama, an awakened Siddhartha Gautama, a Buddha, cannot bring me to awakening, can he? I'm responsible for it. But the most fortunate thing in my life is that he left a clear Dhamma that I can develop and achieve awakening. And I know it because there it is right in front. I can read about it. I can integrate it into my life. I can listen to people. I can be part of a sangha that discusses it. Again, we're so fortunate that it has a sangha that actually develops the Dhamma that we can talk about it as a sangha, or we couldn't. I mean, I've been in sanghas of hundreds of people. And if you said, what's the second noble truth? You get hundreds of people with their heads spinning around because they wouldn't know it. The Buddha taught a singular Dhamma that anybody can develop. And I just want to touch on those other two suttas and then conclude. So then the Buddha taught this sutta, which when you look at the sutta on the Four Noble Truths, in a general way, it speaks to impermanence and also, of course, includes the not self-characteristic, and it, of course, includes dukkha, the three marks of existence. But most importantly is that it speaks to the impermanence of ignorance, that we can develop this path and empty ourselves of ignorance. The second sutta that the Buddha ever gave, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, speaks to that second mark of existence, the anatta characteristic. And the third sutta, the Fire Discourse, speaks to dukkha. So those first three dukkhas, the first three suttas, covers the problem of what we're to gain insight to. And the reason why I'm saying that is, again, I'm correcting a lot of different maybe misunderstandings. The insight that the Buddha teaches is not a general insight into everything that's occurring in the world. That occurs as a natural consequence of having a well-concentrated mind with the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. The insight, the only insight useful within the Buddha's Dhamma, is insight into these three marks of existence. Seeking any other type of insight is simply just another distraction, which is another common problem. We'll pick an object, whatever it might be, washing the dishes. I got to be mindful of washing the dishes. Well, being mindful of what you're doing when you're washing the dishes is a good idea. But what's more important is to be able to relate the Eightfold Path to doing the dishes. And so if you find yourself agitated because your spouse didn't do the dishes tonight, it's not to be mindful of the dishes and avoid your upset. It's to be willing and able to address your upset in your own mind, which takes the Eightfold Path, not the distraction of, oh, I'm mindful of the suds and the suds feel warm and this dish and all of that. That's not it. Insight into the three marks of existence and knows everything the Buddha taught. Again, he awakened to dependent origination, was addressed in the context of Four Noble Truths, and then in a slightly inferior way, but not inferior in any other, in a Dhamma way, to those other two suttas. So that's the talk tonight on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. I hope you found it beneficial. And so any questions directly related, and then we'll just go all the way around the room if we get a chance to get to everyone tonight. There's two folks here tonight. And two online. No questions? Oh, okay, well, it's ladies first. I'd love to hear what you have to say, Diane.
What'd you say? Directly related?
Well, about tonight's talk. What do you got to say about the talk? Did you find it helpful? What did you find helpful?
It's not the first time that I've heard it. So it refreshes. You know, it's refreshing. You know, thoughts and... But I don't know. It's just... I've been saying this a lot lately, and I'm sorry for my repetition, but everything that you mentioned, the not-self, the impermanence, and the three marks of existence, all of the things, when I'm in the five clinging aggregates, each one of those, it seems like daily, weekly, something will happen, you know, a dukkha will happen, or dukkha a lot of it happens, or whatever. And I'm going to the breath almost immediately. And just, and I've been working a little bit on my own, on right speech lately, because I realize how important, I mean, each one of the Eightfold is important, but I must be needing to do that right now. Anyway, and learning to take a breath before I speak is, I'm trying to nurture that so that I do this, I have been quick-witted a lot in my life, and it's gotten me into trouble sometimes, and things haven't been quite as funny as they, you know, as I thought they were going to be, or something like that, or I mean, it's ignorance. Okay. So, and I think just the breathing for me allows me to have a more focused mind on the presence, and, I don't know. I mean, is this on what you talked about or not?
Yeah, I think.
Close enough?
Yeah, the significant thing about what you're talking about is not just the breath. You're talking about seeing things in the with a refined mindfulness of right view and right speech. You mentioned, and that's the point. You know, integrating the Eightfold Path. It's just that way, Diane. Thank you, Kevin. Good to see you tonight.
So simple, you know, it's so direct and it's laid out just like that, and it's so obvious, even. And it's so difficult. So like you have said before, it's not for the faint of heart.
No.
It, in moments of meditation, you can glimpse it. You can really see that this is what Buddha was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you get up from your cushion, you get up from your chair, and launch back into life, and it's so difficult to maintain that mindfulness moment by moment. But what we can do is review it and talk about it and belong to a Sangha and study it and meditate on it. You know, when I meditate, I'll meditate on my breath. You know, I focus on the breathing just like we do. And as much as, you know, sometimes it can be very, I can be very distracted. And then after I finish meditating twice a day now, I consciously review the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and I recite them to myself and go through them and think about them and how they relate, and then hoping that they will integrate more and more if I do that by repetition too. But it's very difficult. It's just, you know, you can see how far there is to go.
Yeah.
Thank you. Helping us get there.
Yeah, thank you. And the distance doesn't really matter, does it? You know, I mean, you like to have the task accomplished like the Buddha described, but what's really important is just maintaining a Dhamma practice. Because if we've really taken a refuge, we know what the end game is. You know, we just got to keep doing it, keep maintaining that right effort. And why not? I mean, what, you know, why would you, once you understand what the Buddha teaches and get a glimpse of reality, why would you want to do anything else? You know, and it is just that simple, you know, but it has to be diligently applied to. The reason why I taught this now, well, a few reasons. One, I just thought that after our 12-week in-depth look at how to develop the Eightfold Path and all the other supportive teachings, that it would be a good idea just to hear that first sutta again, how we, and I never, I was surprised that it was an online student that pointed out where the Four Noble, I have a section on the webpage, Four Noble Truths, but nowhere did I have the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. I've written it out in a few different ways, but never just the sutta. So I wanted to do that and give some talks to it, just so that's established too. That's important. But
yeah, so we have, you know, talk about it on retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was surprised when he told me. I go, wait a minute. I went on the website. I said, I must have put it in the books. It's not. But I will. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the everything I just said tonight is in there. Is in the books and on the website, but just not in that formal way. So I want to do that. And I'm still re-editing the Becoming Buddha. That'll be done one of these days. Any other questions or comments? Our retreat is in a month, so neither one of you going to be there. I shouldn't even bring it up. Oh, well. Online, folks.
You can be supportive of it.
You will be.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, let's. We'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta like we always do. So find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, just take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And being mindful of the impermanence of all things, including ill will. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Thank you for joining online. If you found benefit from this teaching, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Easy.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.